Hello and welcome to Bike Back Chats Books. This week we're headed to the Old Bailey with Henry Milner, a long-time criminal defence solicitor who's represented some of the most notorious criminals in the UK and some of the most notorious criminal cases in the UK. His new book, No Lawyers in Heaven, recounts stories from a lifetime spent in the courts, and we caught up with him to chat a bit more about it. Welcome, Henry. Henry Milner, welcome to the Bike Back virtual podcast.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. We're here to talk about your book, No Lawyers in Heaven. So I thought we'd get started by asking, what made you want to write your memoirs?
Well, I didn't want to write them. It never occurred to me to write them. But I'd written a crime fiction book, which is coming out next year, which at the moment's entitled The Only Gangster in Heaven, about a loan shark dropped dead outside the Old Bailey. And I was discussing it with Olivia Beattie, the editor, and over lunch, and I was telling her a few stories about my career and some of the cases. And it was her suggestion that I should write an autobiography and bring out the crime novel the following year. I didn't take it seriously, but I tried my hand at a few chapters, which dragged on forever. I sent them to her, and I sent them also to John Matthew QC, who's a barrister I've been using for over 30 years, is much older than me, unfortunately, sadly, died recently. But he had a look at them, and he rang me up, and he said, Henry, I've only got two words to say to you, more please. But when the pandemic set in, and I had no new cases in sight, I sat at home with a clear head and started writing. And that's where we are. Finally, I finished,
which is surprise
to me.
So what is the meaning behind the title in that case?
Well, I started with a very moral title, which my family loved. I Didn't Come to Lose, the line from the Tom Paxton song, which I always liked when I was younger. But I decided that was too moral. And then I changed to an over-clever title, Presumed Innocent, Assumed Guilty. And then I, on the influence of a very good bottle of Brunello, I came up with the title Miracles Cost Extra, which was Olivia's favourite, but I couldn't live with it. So finally, I decided that No Lawyers in Heaven is because whatever verdict you get, someone's upset with you. So that if policemen, judges, and prosecutors and clients were the gatekeepers to my entry in heaven, one of them would object. Because if they're convicted, the client's going to object. And if they're acquitted, the police will hate it, and the judge might not like it. So you can't please everybody. And a lot of lawyers take themselves a little bit too seriously and get too moralistic about which cases they take and how it's everyone's right to be defended, whatever the crime. But most of them come into criminal law because it's interesting. And it's not so much a desk job.
I can imagine. And from the stories in your book, it looks very much like it's a very interesting career packed with characters, actually. So let's kind of start getting into that. Can you talk to me a bit about what made you want to become a solicitor and how you went about doing it, basically? How does one become a solicitor, and then how did you go make the jump to criminal law from there?
I'll tell you what happened. I was 9 years at boarding school, and we had a careers master there. Didn't think I was one of great intellect, and he decided that he should part me off to the College of Estate Management in Kensington for a BSc in estate management, whatever that meant. And after 2 years there failing building construction because I can't draw, the principal called me in and told me that I should look elsewhere. And because I'd unbelievably come top in the law exam they had at the college, he'd recommend me to any university I wanted to study law. So I fancied going to the London School of Economics, and by a fluke, I managed to get in about a week before the term started. And so I studied law at London School of Economics. Having done that, you've got to spend 2 years in articles. You've got to, they used to call it articles then. You've got to be employed by somebody for 2 years before you can qualify as a practicing solicitor. And I went to an agency and the lady parked me off to see a one-man band in Cork Street, which is the art capital of London in the West End. And it turned out that he specialized in defending criminals or people charged with crime, which sounded very interesting. And I was taken on at £5 a week, which wasn't great, but it was very interesting. I learned a lot there. So after 2 years there, when I wasn't taken on as a partner because he didn't want any partners and he wasn't going to pay me, I was on £28 a week when I left there 2 years later. And so I went to work for a firm in Knightsbridge that specialised in divorces, but in Milner Street. That's the only reason he took me on, I think, because my name was the same as the street. And after there, I heard such tales of cruelty that I couldn't stand anymore. And a friend of mine knew a couple of lawyers who'd started up a firm in the East End, deep in the East End, doing conveyancing. They didn't have a criminal department. And I went there and I had to do, you had to practice for 3 years with another firm before you could go by yourself. You weren't allowed to start by yourself. So they didn't have one criminal case. That was the problem. But it was in the East End. And eventually a few cases came in and that's how I started. So it's all a bit of a fluke. I stumbled into criminal law because that's where I was went for my interview. Then I stumbled out of it when I went to do family law for 6 months. And then I went back in and I liked it. And that's where I stayed. And then after years there, I moved to a little office in the West End with no window, which I shared with an old school friend. He did conveyancing and company law. And I had four cases. That's all I had at the time. We started together. And that's how it started. And it built up from there.
Yeah, what is it that you like what about doing criminal law as opposed to, let's say, family law that you did for 6 months and didn't enjoy at all?
It's an education. To be honest, I didn't know where Rotherhithe was before I started doing criminal law. I actually thought Rotherhithe was near Brighton somewhere. Because I come from North London and it sounded as if it should be near Brighton. Driving to all the courts and scenes of alleged crimes in South London, East London, actually taught me my way around London. And you wake up with a bounce. You've got an exciting day ahead of you, possibly. You might be going to court to do a bail application. You might be visiting somebody new in prison who's got a real problem, obviously, who's in prison. Or you might have a difficult client in the office come in, or you might be going to court to see your client give evidence or listen to a closing speech. So it's, if you compare it, for example, with conveyancing, which to my mind is the most boring form of law, I wouldn't have stayed in the law if I was doing conveyancing. And family law, I just couldn't bear it any longer. And so I was lucky.
And when you started, were there greats in the industry that you looked up to?
I didn't know anybody in the industry, but when I got my first big case in 1975, I instructed a barrister who must have done in the end maybe 30 cases for me. He was much older than me. He was called Victor Durand, QC. He was the top man at the time. And he did my first big case, which was the robbery of the Daily Express in 1975, when £175,000 was stolen with an armed robbery. And I don't know how the client got hold of me then. They used to tease me, he found me in the Yellow Pages. And maybe he did. I don't think I was in there. But it was my first personal case at the Old Bailey, where I wasn't, you know, and it was very exciting. And he agreed to take the case. And the client had found at his home keys to a lock-up garage in which there was guns, masks, and all equipment to do with a robbery. And they connected it with what had happened at the robbery, and he was charged with conspiring to commit the robbery, even though they weren't suggesting he was necessarily at the scene, but he was. They alleged he was reconnoitering, and it was a safe house, the garage, to look after the weapons. And actually, he was kept for 3 days at the police station, and they wouldn't let a lawyer in. In those days, for serious bank robberies, they never let a lawyer be present at the interview, unless he was caught, because unfortunately there was a practice of what became known as verballing. And that if the police thought that the man was guilty, they would be often tempted to put down remarks that he hadn't actually made. Like, you and I both know that I'm guilty, but you'll never prove it. Or don't expect me to tell you who else was on the robbery. Or when they arrive at his home, oh, I've been expecting you. I thought you'd be earlier. Or when asked, how did you pay for your cruise with your wife last summer? He might say, well, not from this robbery, that's for sure. So then they'd say, well, from another robbery then? And half admissions. And so the trial, when it came to trial, the jury would hear all the police officers give evidence about what he's supposed to say. But in those days, it wasn't recorded. There were no tape before 1984. There was no tape recordings. And so it was, who do you believe, him or me? And sometimes there was very little other evidence to go with it. You might have somebody who was living above his means, but also had been verbal, or he was keeping bad company. But sometimes the police, sadly, couldn't stop themselves from improving their prospects of a conviction by putting down remarks that weren't said.
Well, it sounds like the police are almost as bad as the criminals in that case.
They put it that they thought the end justified the means.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear they now do have tape recorders in interview rooms. It sounds like that clears up a lot of the problems. So for those who know less about criminal law than you, for instance, can you talk me quickly through what it is that you do, like from taking on the case to appearing in court? What are the ins and outs or the basics of the job?
Well, first, you get a telephone call from somebody, either the client, if he's at the police station, or if he's been charged and he wants to change, you might get a call from his wife or his brother, telling you which prison he's in. And then I find myself asking the person who recommended them, or who recommended him, and if it's a serious case, they'll always say, I'm not allowed to tell you. Which is a good sign that means it's probably a serious case of somewhere. And then if he's in prison, you'll arrange an appointment. If he's on bail, he'll come in and see you. Also, of course, you might get a call from the police station saying, we've arrested a man, this is his name. He wants you to be present during the interviews. Will you come along? So if you go along to the interview, you're allowed to see him privately for as long as you like. And the police have to give you a summary of why he's been arrested and what the main facts are against him. And then you'll advise him whether to answer questions or not. Now, in the old days, before going back many years, they couldn't hold it against you if you didn't answer questions. So no jury could hold it against you if you didn't answer questions. But nowadays, that's changed. So if you don't answer questions, it can, in certain circumstances, be held against you. The jury entitled to take it into account. They can't convict you just because you didn't answer questions, but it goes into the scales against you. So that's a major change in the law. So, for example, if somebody in the old days was asked, I'm making this up, Peter, where were you May the 31st, 3 months ago? And he makes no reply. And then at his trial, a year later, says, I remember I was visiting my grandmother in Manchester. The fact that he hadn't answered when he was originally interviewed couldn't be held against him. But now it would, because they'll say, well, why didn't you say that when you were arrested? So it goes into the scales against you.
So when you became a solicitor in the 70s, then London, I imagine, has changed quite a lot since you started practicing. So what kind of challenges did you face as a solicitor then, like, you've already talked about verballing, and I imagine that was quite a nightmare for people in court if you're trying to defend someone, the police are also trying to stitch them up.
What changed? What you had going in the defendant's favour those days was, firstly, as I've just said, the fact that they remained silent couldn't be held against him. Secondly, actually, when I began, you could object just to some of the jurors without giving any reason. So the people in court waiting to be called, that have about 18 or 20 people waiting, and then their names would be shuffled, and the clerk of the court would call out their names, hopefully from a shuffled pack. And if you didn't like, you could object to three without giving any reason. So ridiculously, if you had, let's say, four people on up for a conspiracy to rob, amongst them, they could object to 12 jurors. If you didn't like the fact that he's got the Times in his pocket, or the lady was wearing a red dress, or whatever. But nowadays, that's gone a long time ago. And you can only object now if you know the person or got some really good cause. So that's one thing that's changed. And now they've got sentencing guidelines. Every serious crime, judges sit and they've written out sentencing guidelines. So if you are caught in possession of a kilo of cocaine with intent to supply, you could be easily looking at 9 or 10 years. And if you plead guilty, you still might get, you could get a 30% off, you might get 7 years. And if it, but that's, it's not set in stone, and the judges don't have to follow it, but that's their starting point. So they look, they start off with what the guideline says, and then they can increase it. For example, if the man's got a previous record, or he's brought youngsters into his team, or he might reduce it if the man needed money to pay for an operation for his sick grandmother or whatever, so that they take into account that whether he's got a, it's his first time he's been in trouble. So you didn't have that then. So in, when I started, you might get one judge for an armed robbery sentencing someone who was known as a heavy sentencer, sentencing someone to 15 years. And in the next court, you might get another judge giving him 10 years. That's all gone.
I mean, that sounds good.
Well, it's actually a much better system now, because it doesn't really matter very much which judge you get. It did in the old days. But what's assisted the prosecution of serious crime in the last 20 years is the mobile telephone, because of the printouts they get. And you can almost follow someone's route by a printout from their phone. And you can see what calls they've received and whether the phone is off during the crime, or whether it gets busy after the crime, or whether a man changes his phone every week. That's been of great assistance to the justice system from the police point of view. And then there's the presence of cameras everywhere, DNA to an extent in certain types of cases as well. But I think the mobile phone has really been of great assistance to prosecutions.
Yeah, absolutely. So then turning our attention to some of the people on the other end in the docks, your book is full of very colourful anecdotes about people that you've represented and cases that sometimes kind of boggle the mind a little bit. Who, out of all of the clients that you have represented, who would you say that your favourites have been, or the ones that stood out most to you when you represented them?
Well, you know, oddly enough, the least trouble are the ones who one might be called the professional. They know the system and they don't moan and groan. The most troublesome client is the beginner, especially if he's stubborn, because you really have to teach them the system. They don't even know who gives evidence first, what evidence is heard first in court, when do I get a chance to speak. And so you have to sort of give them a tutorial in the criminal procedure. And then the beginner might try and be over clever when he's giving his evidence, or start trying to make jokes, hoping the jury will sympathize with him. But those who are experienced are much easier to deal with. They know the problems in their case. You know, I always say to a client, if I think he's a professional client, what do you think is the worst point against you? So that brings them down to earth. And then when they ring you, they'll say, oh, I've got a little problem I want to discuss with you. It doesn't mean it's a little problem. It could be a major problem. So the beginner is often very difficult. Mm. And take far longer to prepare than with somebody who's experienced in the court system. I think my favourite client was a man called Mickey Lawson, who unfortunately died about 10 years ago. And in the Brinksmack trials, he was charged with buying the smelter, which was needed after the robbery of £26 million of gold to melt it. And he had a terrific sense of humour. And the police had a tip-off in Hatton Garden after the robbery that a man had come in and asked to buy where he could buy an enormous smelter. And the police had been tipped off, so they started watching him, and they followed him when he went to pick it up 2 weeks later in his Rolls Royce, and it couldn't fit in the boot without the boot being left open and stuck together with some string. And then they followed him secretly for hours, and then they managed, although they had four police vehicles and two motorbike outriders, they managed to lose him at home, and then they had to release him because they couldn't prove what had happened. But anyway, he was eventually charged and stood trial, and he had a very good sense of humour. And he was represented by Bruce Loughlin QC, who was a very elegant barrister. And he made a terrific closing speech for him, after which the client said to him, Mr. Loughlin, your speech was so good that even I started to believe I'm innocent. And then years later, he always put himself out to recommend clients to me if he could. And years later, he was charged with smuggling £3 million of cannabis in carpets from abroad. He was convicted, but the judge had, in his summing up, had told the jury something he wasn't supposed to have told them, which had been ruled inadmissible, and we appealed. Now, the court didn't give a decision, a court of appeal on that day. They adjourned their decision, and they said they'd send it round, which they did about a month later, and it came to the lawyers in a transcript. But you're not allowed to tell your client the result for 12 hours until the hearing the next day, in case there's some technical mistake in their ruling, which gives the lawyers a chance to correct it. But of course, he'd heard about this from prison, that there was this system, and he rang me that the afternoon before. Have you received the decision? Yes, but I can't tell you. And he said, from the way you're saying that, I think we've won. So I said, well, we'll find out tomorrow whether you're a good judge of character or not. So I think he went away too happy from the phone. Anyway, he was right. He was a very nice client. And in one of his cases, they'd seen him on a boat and he had a bit of a fat stomach. And the customs had taken photographs of him on a boat and handed the defense the photographs as part of their evidence. And he had the photographs changed so that he was more muscly, bare-topped, and he had a completely flat stomach. he wanted them handed round to the jury instead of the ones which the customs had taken. But he was. I remember him with a certain affection.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you become friends with some of your clients once you finish representing them, or is there strictly a professional boundary there?
I might go out for lunch occasionally with a client who's been a client for years or who's recommended me cases, but I don't go out in the evening, and I don't have anybody over to my home or anything like that. No, I think it's important you keep a certain distance.
That does make sense. So what was the favourite case you've ever taken?
The one with the most atmosphere was the Kenneth Noy murder trial in 1985, when a policeman was killed on his land at night. It's a very famous case. And the policeman was dressed up in a balaclava and army outfit, and it was in the dead of night. And shouldn't have really been there. And he was there, in my view, without his warrant card, so that he couldn't prove who he was. And Noy heard a noise from his dogs, who were out in his 20 acres of land, and went out to investigate. And there was a terrible fight. And unfortunately, the policeman was killed, and Noy was arrested and charged with murder. And his case was that he was acting in self-defense. There's a very long chapter on it in the book, so I don't want to give it all away. But professionally, it was very satisfying, although it was a real tragedy what happened.
I was wondering as well, are there people who find it quite contentious what you do, defending criminals, or is that just part and parcel of the job?
Well, a moralist will say, oh, well, the prosecution, they have their own barristers doing their best to get your client down, and you do your best to get him off, and everybody's got a right to be defended properly. And that's true. But as I said earlier, I think most people come into this field of law because they know it's going to be enjoying, and not sitting around doing nothing all day or sitting around an office all day. You're out and about. There's excitement. You can think about cases on the way home. It's a puzzle sometimes. It's not just filling out documents. The civil law, the top civil lawyers earn a lot more than the top criminal lawyers. And I think they look down on us a bit. They don't want to dirty their hands defending people charged with crime. But that's the way it is. And they don't say it, but you feel it. Mm. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would do it again if I wouldn't make the same mistakes. I probably would.
Well, now we can all enjoy it as well, because we can all read your book. So drawing the conversation round to a close in that case, what's one thing you hope people take away from reading No Lawyers in Heaven?
Well, a better understanding of the criminal system, and in particular how interesting and humorous and fascinating it was when I started with what went on in courts. When going to a criminal case was as good as going to the theatre with the police verbally and what used to go on in those days. So there were no holds barred then, anything went. And hopefully that they find the book an easy read and it's not bogged down with names and facts and figures. And that's why I put so many stories in the book as illustrations, because I think the public love a good story, and I tried my best in each chapter of the book to give examples of cases.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly enjoyed reading it, and so I can heartily recommend it to all of our listeners. Henry, thank you very much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If hearing Henry's stories made you want to find out more about criminal law, then why not check out his book, No Lawyers in Heaven? It's out now and available from Bite Back Publishing and all good online retailers. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.